Welcome to the How I Got Hired podcast. I'm your host, Sonal Behel, former HR director and founder of Supercharge. And I have had an insane corporate career that started out in India, then moved to South America, and then to Europe, often working only in Spanish or French, which I had to learn there from scratch. Now, why do I call my career insane? Because while I've experienced complete highs, like working across geographies and industries, while navigating challenges like needing visa sponsorships, zero network locally, during recessions, and often while being a new mom to one of my two kids, I have seen career heartbreak and multiple layoffs as well. As a career strategist, I strongly believe that a fulfilling career is a birthright and not a privilege for the lucky few who have access to prestigious education, capital, and networks. And now I am on a mission to democratize access to high-value career advice by designing affordable digital courses with my YouTube channel and this podcast right here, where we learn together from ordinary people like you and me and how they created extraordinary career success. I hope this episode reminds you that if they could do it, you can do it too. Now, get ready to get supercharged. Let's go. Hey, welcome back. I am so happy that you decided to press play on today's episode. I am such a fan. I'm going to fangirl right now and just get it out of my system. Okay, I've been following Sam Gratton for 4 years on LinkedIn, where I came across one of his videos. I don't remember. I think it was a video. It was a skit. It was some kind of sketch. And then there was also guitars in there, and there was this glamorous rock star in there. I was like, what is this guy? What is he doing on LinkedIn? And what I loved about Sam's content here on the platform were that it comprised of all my favorite components. It is educational, it's entertaining, and third, energizing, the three E's. So who is Sam Gratton? You're wondering. Sonal, just get on with it. Okay, we've got you. Sam is the founder of Gratton Communications. It's a communication training firm that helps people with business English as well as public speaking, among other things. So his firm's clients include CEOs and management teams at companies like Air France, KLM, Amazon, LinkedIn, ThyssenKrupp, etc. So what we're going to do today is get behind his journey, retrace those steps that Sam took to move from, you know, very corporate, very respectable and responsible looking jobs in banking, where he was, you know, very senior at JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Banco Santander, and went ahead to start his very own training firm from scratch. We got so much to learn from you, Sam. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Sonal. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I must admit that I myself am a fanboy of what you do, both on LinkedIn and also through your podcasts, the energy and humor and openness that you bring to communications. So it's a real pleasure to be here.
That's so kind, Sam. Beautiful. Let's get right into it. And you clearly seem to have taken that corporate path that I talked about in the intro with the MBA and everything, right? And then such a successful banking career. So before we move on to Gratton Communications and all of that good stuff, I do want to ask you, when you were younger, so I have a 2-3-part question here because I'm greedy. So A, did you always think you'd be doing like banking stuff? And second, talk to us about the most unforgettable role or job that you feel you were so lucky to have had in this industry in this period, and how did you get hired there?
Okay, let me see if I can address all three of those points individually. So, well, like as a kid, or as a teenager, as an adolescent, and going into my 20s, I had no idea what I wanted to be. I really didn't. I had all these different ideas of doing something creative, doing something corporate, doing something entrepreneurial. And I kind of look at my, I've got three daughters, and I look at them and I think, wow, you know, they have a very clear idea of what they want to do. Like one of them wants to be a teacher. One of them wants to go into engineering. The other one wants to be a fashion designer. And they've got that really clear in their heads. And I admire them for that because I didn't have that. I really didn't know what direction I was going to head in. And so what happens is you kind of then go to university, do a course that's interesting. I studied economics, which I thought was super interesting. And then you kind of just, well, in my case, fall into something. You kind of fall into what's out there and what's available. And living in London, there's a lot of people working in finance, not just in the banks, but also peripheral businesses related to finance. And I started working for a market research company, a market research consulting company, helping banks improve their services. And it wasn't like I had any dream to do that. It was just, I was flicking through the job advertisements in the Financial Times. There was something there that appealed to me. I applied to it and I got the job.
Back in the day when it was actually in like newspaper jobs and newspapers,
exactly.
Right?
Yes, for our younger view, your younger listeners, you're not really going to know what we're talking about here. But back in the day, there in the back of newspapers, there'd be lots of job advertisements, and as you're indicating, you'd circle the things
with
the
red pen.
Exactly, exactly. Yes. So I got that. I just fell into that first job, and it clearly wasn't really the thing that you know I wanted to do for the rest of my life. You know, I kind of like made enough money to rent a flat and have a good time and live a nice life in London. But I think I felt a little bit unfulfilled and also directionless. Yeah. And that's why I did an MBA. So I was one of the people that chose to do an MBA because they didn't really know where their career was going and wanted something else, but didn't quite know what it was. So I think a lot of people look at senior people in senior positions and think, you know, they always knew that that was where they were going to be, right? That was, there's somebody who has very clear objectives and they achieve those objectives. Whereas the reality is probably for most people very different.
Quite
you kind
messy,
of bounce around.
Quite messy.
Yeah,
yes.
Messy,
yes.
Exactly. You bounce around and then eventually you end up doing something you enjoy. So I did an MBA and I was fantastic in Barcelona at the ISE Business School. Met some really, really wonderful people. You know, I have some wonderful friends. I've met my wife, my future wife there as well.
Ooh, what could be a bigger ROI? I honestly don't know.
I know the ROI was maxed out. Could not have been a better investment for me at all. And so you learn a lot through, in this case, the case study method about strategy, about finance, about accounting, and all the different disciplines within business. But I think from business school, what you learn, or what certainly what I learned, which was most valuable to me, was kind of where I sit in my peer group. You know, because you're in a classroom of 70 people and you go through all the disciplines of business and you discuss business problems and you do the analysis and you argue and you debate and you can very clearly see the talent that's around you.
Yes.
You can very clearly see that this lady here knows accounting, right? It comes to her really naturally, she likes it, she's good at it, she crunches the numbers in a way that I will never be able to compete with. So if I go into accounting, I'm going to be competing with somebody like that who just does it so well. So maybe accounting's not for me. And then you listen to somebody else who analyzes a business problem in an incredibly insightful way, just gets to the heart of the problem, solves the problem, and you're thinking, whoa, I mean, they're really insightful. They really see through business problems. They can find solutions. If I'm going into consulting, I'm going to be competing against somebody like that.
And it's like that buzzer.
Yeah. I mean, I might be able to be a reasonable accountant and a reasonable consultant, but these guys are going to be my boss. You know, this is maybe not, that's not the area that I should go into. And we had a course in communications. And one of the things that we had to do is we had to get up and give a speech. And so I prepared my speech. My speech was about oranges and I was promoting oranges and I was trying to persuade my colleagues at business school to drink orange juice in the mornings rather than coffee or, you know, anything less healthy as a really good way of starting the day. And it was a speech that had a little bit of humor in it, you know, a little bit like my LinkedIn videos. It's a bit cheeky.
Your signature, sure.
Yeah, a little bit controversial as well, kind of like make people think and wake people up a little bit. And it went really well. Like it was a big success. And one of my friends came up to me like a few hours later, and he said, like, you'll never believe this, but the cafeteria is sold out of orange juice. Like, after your speech, I wanted to go and get some fresh orange juice, some freshly squeezed orange juice.
Are you kidding me?
And I couldn't get any because there was none left. And so, like, that's when I thought, okay, sales has got to be my thing. Sales is where I can differentiate myself from other people. So I'm good at persuading people to do something, or good at persuading people to buy something. So that's how I differentiate myself relative to my peer group. So maybe that's the area that I should go into. So rather than kind of going into finance and going into banking and thinking that was what I wanted to do, it was actually the activity, the job itself, that was the defining factor.
Understood.
So I wanted to be in sales. I wanted to be a salesman. Okay. And it just happened that the companies that came recruiting were consulting companies and banks. And there were also some large industrial companies as well, but they were looking for, you know, other roles. It was the banks that were looking for salespeople. And so that's why I ended up in banking, because I recognized that I was relatively good in sales, and it was sales that they were offering at the banks.
I'm going to pause you here. This is fantastic. I did not expect this answer. So this is so much fun. I want to unpack this. First of all, my daughters have it figured out. At that age, I didn't know what I was doing. I think that is the norm. Most of us do not know what we're doing. And some of us are still figuring stuff out in our 40s. It's perfectly okay. But I also want to say, you know, give credit where it's due. Good on your daughter. Some people just get it. I have two kinds of guests on the show. Those who knew from a very early age, I want to be a doctor. That is my thing. Or those who said, I will, no matter what, I will own a business. There is no right or wrong. But the beauty is that as young as your kids are, and this is true for anyone who's listening, who's got kids or, you know, nephews, nieces, you can always change your mind. You know, there isn't that pressure. We don't have to stay that way. And we're going to talk about, I feel like you're the king of career pivots, because you've done your fair share of those. So we will talk about that. So whether they want to get into fashion, teaching, engineering, and later they say, actually, you know what, halfway through the degree, I decided to do something. I've had, you know, very successful people who came on the show and said, I thought it was this way because it looked like it from the outside, but the reality is a little bit different when you open the curtains, you know, and you see what's behind the scenes.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I'm really proud of them that they have a vision of where they want to go, but whether, you know, in 10 years or 20 years time, they're all going to be doing those things. I think I'm pretty like open-minded about that.
Exactly.
Time will tell, absolutely. And if they do at any point want to change careers or perhaps go into further education, do an MBA or a higher degree, then I'm totally supportive of that, which is a big shift in generation. So their grandfathers would have been of the mentality
Heart attack. In India, this would be pure recipe for
exactly,
like a cardiac.
Exactly. It's like, get onto a career path and work your way up the corporate ladder and stick with it. Do not change under any circumstances, even if it's stressing you out, even if you're unhappy, just keep pushing through. And there is something to that argument, because at times we do have to do things that are challenging for us. There are moments where it's uncomfortable and we have to push through those moments. But in our generation, and certainly from my experience, I would be very supportive of any of my daughters or any friends or family who decide to change career at whatever age, you know, 40s, you know, maybe even beyond that.
Maybe beyond that.
It's possible to do that.
Exactly. And it doesn't mean that if somebody changes their track, it doesn't make them less intelligent. I think it makes them more courageous. But I'm so glad that you're talking about this, Sam. I have a 15-year-old. He's going to be 16 in a month, and he's going into his GCSEs in a couple of weeks. I am shocked at the number of parent friends who are asking me about what he wants to do. I'm like, really? at that yeah. age, you knew what you wanted to do. So he's picked out his subjects, you know, A-levels, is it IB, A-levels, at least, okay, he has an idea of that. And I just felt like there was so much pressure on his shoulders. And I was like, dude, you know, your dad and I have an MBA. You can always do something else. And then he felt such relief when we said that. And I was like, why are you? Yeah, because my friend said, if I don't do maths opens up more avenues. And I'm like, stop. So yes, it's true for our grandparents' generation, but I think some of that carries forward because they talk to their friends. And it's like, this is the only way to success. I don't think I should study history because it's very narrow and, you know, maths will open more doors. And I'm like, stop listening. Like, you have to be so careful because this is already, it's already starting, you know, the generational sort of trauma that carries forward. Cool. MBA, fantastic idea. I've said this on a YouTube video as well. When you don't know what you're doing, you want to figure things out. MBA is an insurance. It's also an exploration. You meet people. You could meet your future life partner if you're as lucky as Sam. And have this beautiful family that comes out of it and you decide, oh, I love this country so much, I'm going to live here. Not only am I going to live here, I'm going to open a business here and employ people.
Yes.
Right? So this is great. And I'm so glad you talked about the group because I did my MBA from INSEAD, Sam. The group work, especially in the early sort of 4 or 5 months, oh my God, it's intense. I see you know, get a sip of water. It is intense yes. in that period. And you see such successful people that imposter syndrome is so real. And I also, by process of elimination, decided I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. Ooh, this one I might be good at. And I love this epiphany moment, thanks to your orange.
Yeah.
So it was function focused. It wasn't like you were gravitated towards banking. It was related to sales, and sales is beautiful because sales is useful in every single industry. There's no industry that says we don't need salespeople.
Correct.
And so you had these, I call these sort of this triad, right? What is that triad? Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs. I'm guessing you had your fair share of these triads at campus. What helped you? Because there must have been so many people who wanted to get into these firms, Sam. And yeah. you ended up going with JP Morgan. Tell us, like, what helped you to stand out during those interviews? I know it was a while ago, but are there some nuggets that you still remember?
Yeah, totally. I remember very, very clearly because it was sort of life-changing for me in many ways. So what happens is at business schools like INSEAD, like ESA, you have the career forum,
yeah.
or the big banks come, or the consulting firms come. You apply for jobs, or you apply for summer internships, because ESA was a two-year course. So you spend summer working. So during the first year, you apply for a summer internship. And so I applied to a few places. I wasn't very successful. I mean, I didn't actually get that many interviews. In fact, I actually only ended up with one interview from all my applications. And that interview happened to be for JP Morgan for a sales job. So I had all my eggs in one basket. So I had to really nail the interview because if I didn't get this, I wasn't sure what I was going to do over the summer. And you could see how everybody else was doing. There were some people who were getting lots of interviews and lots of offers in consulting. And then my friend Rob, who was an ex-tank commander in the British military, who was at business school to transition into a new career, he had interviews from everybody, right? Mm. And he had offers from everybody as well. He had more offers from more banks than he knew what to do with, right? So I went up to him and I said, look, I've only got this one interview. I've got to get an offer.
Yeah.
What are you doing? Like, how are you doing this? How are you getting 100% success rate for every interview that you go to? And he took me to one side, sat down, we had a cup of tea, or maybe we had a cup of coffee because we'd been in Spain for a few months by that time. And he said, okay, listen, you're being interviewed by human resources, okay? And you need to be able to answer three questions, just
yes.
questions, right? But you need to be able to answer these three questions really well. And when you answer, you've got to really believe what you're saying. So I was sitting there drinking my cup of tea thinking, okay, right, what are these three questions? And he said, okay, question number one, why do you want to work at JP Morgan? Question number two, why do you want to work in sales? Question number three, what makes you different from the other candidates? And I was a little bit sort of like, oh, that's pretty obvious, right? I mean, surely, you know, these are the kind of questions that you would expect people to ask and prepare for. And he said, look, it's amazing how few people really nail those questions.
How many wing it because they're like, this is easy. I got this. Oh my God.
Yeah. So how few people actually really do the homework. So they really get to know the company. They call anybody up who's got a connection with the company or working at the company to find out some inside information. They go online, they do all the work that's necessary, and then they prepare and they think and they practice and they get it into their system so that when they actually come to the interview, it sounds like they really believe what they're saying. It's not just that they know all the information. It's that they really feel it when they're answering those questions. And that's what you have to get to. You can't just answer those questions plainly. You have to answer those questions like you really, really believe it. Because if they feel that you know them and you want them, then they will want you in return.
And they will pass you on to the hiring manager as gatekeeper.
Then you go to the next step, which is interviewing with the managers of the departments. So that's what I did. I had about a week and I really took on board what he said, did my homework. And, you know, on the bus on the way to business school, I was going through what I was going to say. I was researching. I was calling people up. I was finding out as much as I could about the role. And what happened is during that week, I really naturally came to believe that I wanted the job. The more I learned about it, the more I thought, wow, what an amazingly cool job this would be. What a great company this is. What a great opportunity this is for me. So that come the interview, I mean, I was completely bulletproof. I was just ready to go. I just sat down. I was like, this job is for me and let me explain to you why. So that's how I got the summer internship. I got a job.
You got a job because the internships are the gateway. Many people don't realize internships are so underrated. Wow, this is a beautiful story. Good on your friend, Rob, because I have worked in HR for 18 years. And this guy, coming from a military background, knows it better than most HR people themselves. So why us? Why sales? And why me? Mm-hmm. So why you, right? If you can nail those three and practice, right? So you teach this in your communication today in your business, but back then you were figuring it out. And the more you practiced and like you're saying, you were, you know, like hyping yourself up on that bus ride, you don't have to pretend anymore because you really do want it. And authenticity, as much as that word gets thrown around a lot, you can't fake that interest and that hunger. Either you are hungry, either you want it, or you don't. This is amazing. And you know, Sam, you said that you applied to quite a few and you got one call back. Do you remember how many you applied to?
I think I probably applied to 5 or 6. So yeah, I probably had about 15-20%.
Yeah. And one is, this is exactly it. It's all it takes. One is all it takes. And you make it count. You know, you did. You made it count. And that's how you landed it. I love the story. And it's extremely relatable. So you are so successful. You do a lot of these other, you know, roles in other firms. Did you always kind of get headhunted? Did you apply? How did it go from there?
So I had a really wonderful summer internship. And I've got a great story to tell you about how that ended. But maybe we'll keep that for the end.
Okay.
And what happened was I then came back for my second year at ESA Business School. And I was like totally relaxed because I had a job offer. I knew that I was going to go to JP Morgan. And, you know, it was like a really lovely position to be in because I could spend another year at Barcelona with all my best friends, learning all this interesting stuff without the pressure of thinking, God, I still want to find myself a job.
Yeah.
So I had that. So arrived at JP Morgan. They sent me off to New York. 6 weeks of training, and I was going into equity sales. So I was selling stocks and shares to institutional investors. That's what I was going to do. So I did my training in New York, and I really worked hard while I was there, and I performed quite well relative to the other new recruits because they were testing us every day. We had tests and it was quite demanding, but I really enjoyed it. I liked it a lot.
Can I just pause you Sam, but I forgot to mention this because you said it was hard when you graduated and also the internship, right? Wasn't this kind of overlapping as well with 9/11 and all the ramifications of that?
Yes.
Or did I spoil? Did I just spoil your story?
No, because I've got so many stories about that summer internship. My contract with JP Morgan is dated September 11th, 2001. That's the date of my contract, my full-time contract at the end. Yeah. So it was right around that time. And actually, so what happened was after 9/11 and after, do you remember the term .com, the .com bubble?
It burst.
But there's all these, all these new companies, these .com companies, as they were called then, they're like technology companies as we know them today. And they were all massively overinflated. Their share prices were super high. It was the same thing with the telecommunications industry. Share prices were massively inflated and over through the roof. And so what happened was, during the year that I was back at business school, before I started my job, everything started to fall apart. I think that part of the market went into recession. And by the time I finished my training in New York and I arrived as a fresh-faced MBA graduate ready to take on the world, nobody in the department would look me in the eye. Right? So people were looking at me like, what are you doing here? You know, we're not recruiting. Yeah. We are actually downsizing. We're firing people. And so that was the environment that I walked into. There was no job for me.
Yeah.
So having had all this excitement, having had the job of my dreams, having been out to New York to get trained and I did well there, to then come back and find that there was nothing there for me was quite a shock because I had £40,000 worth of debt
my
MBA student loan.
Yes.
So that is one of the things when we do talk about the value of an MBA, you have to bear in mind that it's hugely expensive.
It's not cheap.
And actually is significantly more expensive these days than it was when we were doing it. Right.
Yes.
I think inflation in education has been absolutely outrageous over the last sort of 15, 20 years. It's absolutely crazy. Unbelievable.
I did it for 50,000 back in, I graduated in 2009. And by the way, I graduated with the global financial crisis. So the subprime, remember that nutty thing that happened with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Well, it blowed over in Europe. That MBA today is, I believe, 95K. And by the way, Sam, it's 1 year in NCI.
Yeah, 1 year. There you go, 95K for 1 year.
That's just tuition. That's just tuition.
Anybody thinking about doing an MBA has to consider where there's value for money.
Yeah.
And I think when I did it, it was tremendous value for money. I got so much more out of it than I actually paid. But anybody who's looking at 95,000 a year, you know, kind of 150,000 just for the education for 2 years, also considering the opportunity cost of giving up your work for 2 years, the decision is a lot more challenging for people nowadays. So I had a big debt, by today's standards. I had £40,000 worth of debt. I had a child on the way as well. And we just moved into our new flat in London, and suddenly there was no job for me. And this was the job that was going to help me pay off my student debt and help me look after my family.
Scary.
And this is suddenly, it's like the safety net had been taken away and I was in free fall. But JP Morgan is a great company for many reasons. I had a really great experience there. Had some wonderful managers, wonderful mentors, great, great collegiate atmosphere. And so what they did was, their system then was, I went to the human resources department and I had my champion. You know, this was the lady who had recruited me and had been advising me the whole way through. And I'd built up quite a good relationship with her. And she said, okay, so what happens now is you are at risk. So this is what we call it. You're at risk. There is no job for you in equity sales. Okay, so you have a month. You're at risk for a month. You have that month to find a job somewhere else within the company. Okay, so I'm going to help you. I'm going to give you some guidance. I'm going to give you a little bit of advice. I'm kind of trying to sort you out with meetings with different departments. But you just go out and talk to anybody you can and you try and find a job within this company. Okay. That's how they did it. It was like I was free to come and go as I pleased and had one month to find a job within the company.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a really good way of handling it because they didn't just say, okay, there's no job for you, off you go. They actually gave me a shot. They gave me a chance. Yes. And it was down to me to make something happen. And I went, I spoke to everybody that I knew within the bank to see if there were any opportunities. And there was a guy who I had been in New York training with, who I built up a good relationship with. He worked in this department called credit derivatives and structured credit and asset-backed securities, of which I knew absolutely nothing. And he said, listen, our department, we're on fire and we are growing really, really rapidly. And my friend is one of the traders who works on the credit derivatives trading floor at JP Morgan. And he's willing to have a chat with you and tell you a little bit about how things work within the credit derivatives department. Because simultaneously, the contact that I had in HR had set me up with an interview with the managing director of the credit derivatives sales department. So I had this conversation with a friend of a friend. This guy took an hour and a half out of his time to sit down with me in a pub. And in that 1.5 hours, explained to me what credit derivatives were, because I had no idea, what was happening in the market, what was required of a salesperson, and who it was that I was going to meet, and what that person would expect, and what that person's character was.
Okay.
And he told me that this is a guy who is direct, honest, to the point. He's a family man. Just be direct and honest with him in return in the interview. So I was kind of like prepared product-wise, and I was prepared sort of interviewer-wise to go. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the next day, I went for an interview for a job that 24 hours previously I knew nothing about. And the managing director said to me, how on earth did you spend an hour and a half in a pub with our number one credit derivatives trader? And just that gave me credibility, that I had the good fortune of having a friend of a friend, and I happened to sit down with a guy who had a tremendous credibility within this trading floor. So I was basking in the glow of the credibility of this other person. And his name's Samik Chandarana. He was one of the most successful credit derivatives traders over the subsequent decade. And he's now very, very senior within JP Morgan. He's currently, I think, the chief data officer. So he's in charge of implementing all of the artificial intelligence and technology into JP Morgan. So I got I got lucky. And so I had an interview with the managing director of credit derivatives. I passed that and they gave me a shot and they gave me a seat on the trading floor as a credit derivatives salesman. So I was able to transition out of a division that was on its way down at that particular point into a division that was on its way up. And I was able to do that because of this confluence of good fortune, good connections and contacts with the HR person and with my friend from New York, and also like the ability to adapt and, you know, kind of be willing to try something that's way, way out of your comfort zone.
Absolutely. Completely different. You've not done credit derivatives before. I've had friends in investment banking, so I'm familiar with a lot of these terms. They go over my head. Must have gone over your head at the time. But I really, really, I want to highlight two things here. This is such, it feels scary listening to you, you know, new flat, baby on the way, expensive MBA, debt, wife is not British. She needs to look for a job. It's hard, that environment, right? And then you were given this sort of 1 month notice from HR. I want to say this, I am that HR. I've laid people off, right? As much as you can, give people time. That's the humane thing to do. I've also been laid off, Sam. I've been on the other side. I talk about this very openly. And you're called into the office and you're told, sorry, get out, you know, basically get lost in very polite words. And then I now read about where people couldn't log into their Google account. It was locked out because, yeah, they don't have a job anymore. You know, people don't have to be, pardon my French, but people don't have to be assholes about it. You know, there is a way to separate with kindness. And it's not pleasant news, but it becomes more unpleasant, not because of what was shared, the content of the message, but the delivery of the message, which is completely goes sideways when it's done in that fashion. Lucky for you, this was done in a proper way. And you were like, all right, bringing on my A game, there is no turning back. And that kindness of that gentleman that you're talking about, he didn't have to, but he did. And I think you're being very humble here, Sam, because you're saying you're very lucky. But obviously, you know, I've had people on the show. There's a particular guy I had on the show called Bob Berg, who's written a book called The Go-Giver. And he says, when you have a referral, you are riding on borrowed trust. But that is it. You know, you had good work. You had a good reputation and people speak highly of you. That guy will give you the time of day. But to do that in a crowded, noisy pub for an hour and a half, they're already sold. It's less about what can you tell us in the interview. They've already made up their mind. So I love this story. And that's how you got the job. And this is fantastic. And now I want to fast forward because we're going to get into another plot twist. I want to see what's happening with you. So 10 years now, you know, September 11, we're now talking about this period of 2011, 2013, because that's what I see on LinkedIn where things get quite interesting, quite salty, quite spicy. You started to make some moves where you're going from working in companies on a full-time basis to starting your own training firm. I want to hear from you that germ that was planted. Like, what was going on at the time? How were you making decisions? And when you finally did start this firm, we also want to know, how was it like in those early days? Because, you know, people, we have this idea in our head that clients are going to bang the door open and they're just going to throw their credit card at us and, you know, dying to work for us and there's a line outside. Reality is not quite as we envisioned. So talk to us about what those early days were like, but also what made you leave the, I'm putting this in air quotes, the safety and stability of working in these companies to starting out from scratch.
Yeah, I think, well, the basis of it is an agreement that I had with my wife, right, back in the early days. It's like she's an MBA and she's brilliant. She's like brilliant strategist, brilliant at marketing. And in fact, we currently run our business together now.
Together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she was sacrificing a lot for me. You know, we moved to London because that's where my job was. Mm-hmm. And we kind of had this implicit agreement that, you know, we'd have like 5 or 6 years in London, maybe a little bit more. And then we'd move back to Spain because it's a great place to bring up kids. And we love the country. Mm. So 10 years later, we're still in London. We're still doing the same thing. The kids are starting to grow up. And the best years have passed because I think probably, as you know, as you well know yourself, from when you started work, the credit derivatives boom was from 2001, which is pretty much when I started, to 2007, 2008. And then everything went horribly wrong. So things started to change within the world of banking. I moved from JP Morgan to Goldman Sachs. I got headhunted by them. And then 18 months later, I got fired by them. So I've also been through the process of losing my job. Okay. And in the 18 months I was with Goldman Sachs, the share price went from $220 to about $70. And it was on the verge of Well, it wasn't never on the verge of bankruptcy, right? It's not, wouldn't be true to say that. But that was when Lehman Brothers went under, Bear Stearns went under, Morgan Stanley looked vulnerable, Merrill Lynch was bought by Bank of America. Like, what's going to happen to Goldman Sachs? So pretty much most of my department got fired at the same time as well. And so that got me thinking, okay, what's my next step? So now is the time to transition to Spain, back to Spain, where I had such a wonderful 2 years, and like, I've got family here and my wife's from Spain. I want my kids to grow up in Spain. So that's why I started working at Banco Santander. So I applied for a job at Banco Santander. I thought that would be a way for me to transition back to Spain, working within the banking world. And it was never going to be like that, because my value wasn't in Spain. My value for Banco Santander was in London, because that's where my clients were and that's where my connections were. And that's where they were selling the products that I was selling. So I was a little bit misguided in that sense. I thought myself that I could move to the Madrid office of Banco Santander, but that was never going to happen. So after about 18 months, a couple of years, I thought, okay, this is not working. I've done my time in investment banking. We've got some savings. It's time to move, right? And I think for every person who's working in a career and has a stable job and a stable income, you can't just quit, right? There has to be something that pulls you. You can't just be pushed out of a career. You have to already know that there's something there that you want to do that's going to inspire you and make you take this leap of faith. And for me, it was becoming a film director.
Ooh, but wait, hold the phone. Film, where is that coming from?
I've always been interested in cinema, and I've always taken photographs and made little videos and video stories and things like that. And so I needed something. I needed something to pull me out of investment banking, something that would be bigger and better and more glamorous and fun, and something that I thought that I could do. So I quit investment banking and I went to film school.
Yes, you did. You didn't just think about it. You actually put your money where your mouth is, and you did a course, quote unquote, practical filmmaking.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Was it everything you expected?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was so much fun. It was at the Met Film School in Ealing. Ealing Studios is where a lot of the great British films from the 50s and 60s were made. And it was
Ealing. Isn't that also where Downton Abbey had a, I think they had
Yes, indeed.
Ooh. Yes,
in good spot. Well done. Excellent knowledge. You are a cinephile. Impressive. Wow. Yes.
Downton Abbey, kind of Downton Abbey nerd here. So.
Yes, that's right. In fact, they shot the interiors of Downton Abbey while I was studying there.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh my God. That
no,
was at
no,
the
no.
height,
I was there
2011,
at that time.
2012. So for all the listeners who were Downton Abbey, fellow Downton Abbey fans, all the downstairs shorts, I believe, were in Ealing, right next to where Sam was. This is unbelievable.
You know more about this than I do. That's incredible.
So you did this course, and what did you think you were going to do next? Like,
I thought that I was going to be a film director. I thought I was going to become a hotshot film director. Like,
Were you already rehearsing the Oscar speeches or not?
Totally. I was totally there. I had to have this delusion, right? I had to have this vision and this dream to actually help me transition into something different. And of course, what happens is reality bites, right? You realize, whoa, man, this is a really tough industry. Like, it's an industry that doesn't make any money. In fact, it's an industry that loses a ton of money. I think like 90% of films lose money. And it's very, very difficult to find work. So I could see in that, once again, a little bit like when I was doing my MBA, you compare yourself to your peer group and you think, okay, I'm good. I'm not good at accounting. I'm good at sales.
Yeah.
And so I compared myself to my peer group. And I thought, there are some incredibly talented people here who are not making it, right? There are some incredibly talented people that come in and teach us who are not making it. So this
and they've been in the game longer than you have.
Yeah, totally.
And it's a ruthless. I completely agree with you. It's a ruthless industry. I've had people on the show who were cast members, who are actors, and the audition process, it's just not personal. It's like, we have a certain thing in mind. Sorry, you're not it. And you It teaches you resilience, but you're a family,
When you've got a family and okay, so we had savings, so we had this grace period, but I kind of even projected, I thought, wow, this is going to take decades, not years. And then on top of that, there's a huge amount of luck involved. I mean, I wanted to be a film director, and I kind of had this idea that I would leave film school and become a film director. And that's a little bit like thinking you can leave university and become CEO of a multinational company. You know, you have to really put in the hours and the days and the years and the decades.
There are some steps in between.
Exactly. So I really recognized very, very quickly that this is an expensive hobby. This is not going to be a career. Mm. And by this time, the family had moved to Spain. So we'd got a place in Spain. They were in Spain. I was finishing off the course at the Met Film School. I was making short films and I was presenting them at various festivals. So they got played at festivals around the world. And I could just see that it wasn't going to make me any money anytime soon. As fun as it was and as creative as it was, it just wasn't going to pay the bills. So with my family now in Spain, it was a case, okay, sit down and write a list of things that you want to do, that you like doing, and you could do, and also things that make money. You know, so that's where we were. We were at that point where it's like Marina was in the same situation. She was giving up what she was doing in the UK, coming to Spain. I was giving up what I was in the UK, coming to Spain. So both of us had to sit down and think, what are we going to do now? What can we do that's fulfilling and fun and it's a long-term prospect and makes money?
Yeah.
So that's where the germ of the idea of creating what has become this business communications consultancy started. And it started with the idea of offering business English classes. Because it's a very, very packed market. Teaching, I think you have experience yourself, don't you, Sonal?
Yes.
So it's very, very competitive. There are lots of people offering their services, people undercutting each other with the prices in order to get the business, having to pitch to human resources departments who are pitched to by so many other people as well. So it's a very, very challenging environment, but there were two things that we had going for us. The first thing was there are very few business English teachers who were executive directors at JP Morgan. So that's kind of how we sold ourselves, right? We're not just English teachers. We actually have business experience and we have managerial experience.
We're from the same industry.
We know what you're going through.
Yes. Right.
So our pitch was not broad-based English to all clients. It was like masterclasses to high-level executives. That's how we pitched ourselves. And there wasn't very much competition. There's a lot of competition at basic level and intermediate level English, but actually there's not very much competition at advanced level English when somebody already has a very solid level of English, but needs more in order to run a department or to take over an international position. And that's where we positioned ourselves.
Got it.
So that was the first good piece of fortune that we had, that there's a niche within this otherwise very competitive market that we could occupy. And then the second piece of good fortune that came to us was when we were trying to build our business, we were speaking to our current clients and kind of getting ideas from them. And one of them said to us, why don't you start putting things on LinkedIn? Why don't you actually start putting pieces of advice on business English onto the LinkedIn platform? And my initial reaction to that was, why would I do that? You know, LinkedIn is for people who are looking for jobs, for HR departments, nothing more than that. So this was back in 2017, so quite a few years ago. And I tried it. I just tried writing a little message, making it focused on business English with maybe a little bit of humor involved, trying to make it memorable, trying to make it personal. And It was amazing the instant feedback that we got from it.
Yes, yes.
From all the different avenues that we were trying to build our business, from SEOs to Facebook ads to putting brochures. I actually went around the neighborhood with my kids putting brochures into all the letterboxes of our neighbors, trying to help build our business. I mean, because we're starting from scratch, we were trying absolutely everything. Every single avenue of marketing, through word of mouth marketing to all these digital marketing to, you know, practical marketing where you're giving out brochures. Mm. And it was LinkedIn that absolutely worked, because in hindsight, it makes total sense because that's where your client base is, right?
Yes, it's good because you got it at the golden age. LinkedIn's golden age was, according to me, 2017 to 2020, just before the pandemic, where reach was amazing. My first article in 2017, I had hundreds of likes that I cannot think about today. And I'm not saying that my content is poor. It's just, it's become such a pay-to-play platform now, but you got it at the right time and your message was unique.
Yes.
Right. And that's what paid off. I love this. And I also want to highlight here, Sam, the blue ocean, red ocean. Where you're separating yourself, the competition is not there. You know, as an MBA, you probably studied about the blue ocean strategy and you saw this in the advanced levels of English where it was missing. And you were like, we are from the industry. So this helps to, I guess, meet objections of, but you don't have a teaching degree. You're like, yeah, so what? Who cares? This is business English, right? I come from business. But those early days, Sam, corporate clients is what we want, because that keeps, and you know, I was working at Berlitz, so like you said, there's retainers. It's easy. It gets comfortable, but it's not easy to get those retainers. So before you landed these big names, you know, how was it attracting? Was it a no-brainer? And they were like, yes, we will sign with you. You know, talk to us about how that must have been like being hired by big firms.
Yeah. So we found human resources departments. Personally, we found it very frustrating, like dealing with them, and we completely understand the pressures that they're under and the amount of solicitations they get from tons and tons of different companies. Like even when we went in to meet human resources departments on the back of word of mouth or a recommendation, it kind of just went nowhere. It's just, you know. So we had to find a way to get around the human resources department. We had to find a way to actually communicate directly with the senior managers, because it was when we spoke to the department heads, it's when we spoke to the senior managers that they recognized that actually, okay, this is something different and this is what we want and we're willing to pay a premium for it. So the problem with the language industry in general, I think, is it's a very price sensitive industry to work in. And there's always somebody who's can come in and undercut you. So if you're dealing with looking at a load of prices and they see that your price is significantly higher than everything else because you're offering a premium product, they don't recognize the fact that it's a premium product. They're not looking at value, they're looking at price. And we found a lot of people looking at price rather than value. And when you speak to a senior manager and you talk about, you're not paying for a unit of classroom time. What you're paying for is a unit of improvement. Mm. And in terms of classroom time, yes, we're significantly more expensive than, you know, the average business English teacher. But in terms of a unit of improvement, we are much cheaper. Yes. Because we're going to get you there quicker because we know exactly what you're looking for. Now, that's an argument that you can make to a senior manager of a department. They'll get it. It's a much more difficult argument to make when you're competing with a ton of other companies all offering lower prices to a human resources department. So we had to find some way of getting around human resources, and that was through LinkedIn.
Aha. And you went and where the people are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically what would happen is that the managers of divisions who needed their teams to improve their communication skills would see the videos, they would see what we're posting on LinkedIn, and they'd say to the human resources department or to whoever, contact these people. We want to recruit them. We want this guy, or we want to see what he can offer.
Yeah.
And it wasn't exclusively senior managers within big companies. It was also the human resources department that were seeing us as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So we were contacted by some fantastic people from human resources departments too. But we had that chance to have a shop front to a client base that represented CEOs, founders, department heads of big companies. And therefore we got our foot in the door and we could pitch to them. And what happens is, I mean, you know a lot about personal branding, right? You do a lot of personal branding yourself through LinkedIn and various other channels. What happens is when you have a personal brand, when people have seen your videos on LinkedIn, when you walk into an office and you go to pitch to them, the work's already done.
Right? Yes.
They greet you like they know you, like you're an old friend. It's like, hi, Sam, come on, sit down. Yeah, I really like that video you did with Rafa from Hombres G. Right, so what can you do for us? I mean, that's what happened in the early days of LinkedIn.
That's what happened.
That's
yeah.
what happened. It was
I love this.
A real door opener to us into the senior accounts that we were trying to
And anyone who's listening today who has doubts, LinkedIn is still extremely helpful. And if there was a little bit of a nudge that you needed, this is it. This story is absolutely it. I'm so happy for you because you put in so much work, you went through your journey. And you know, I will also argue with you because you talked about personal brand and it's not LinkedIn that helped. You also had a personal brand when you went into that pub to meet that dude, Sam, who helped you to understand credit derivatives. It's that reputation. What do people say about you behind when you're not there in a room where you're not there? What do they say about you? We do have some control over that narrative, right? And when you are known and people, like I literally had a call just before our recording right now. And she felt like she knew me because of, you know, 40-minute YouTube videos. And she's like, I want to work together. And I'm like, that's great. But it's not that it was built overnight. It's just little by little, you know, sort of brick by brick. And I'm so glad you talked about the pricing part. I have a friend in Spain, in Barcelona, in fact, in the language industry who gave up because he felt so undercut all the time with prices. And it was purely price driven. And he said, it can't be, forget profitable. He said, it's just an expensive hobby at this point. And it broke my
yes.
heart.
Yes, that's right. So that is, I think, the challenge that every English language teacher faces, particularly if you want to scale.
Yes.
Because
yes.
as soon as you start to scale, then you've got to recruit other teachers and you have to make sufficient margin to make it worthwhile. And considering the industry is so price sensitive, it's
yes.
almost impossible to do that. And that's why the industry is so atomized because yes. it is actually incredibly difficult to build. And anyone that you're going to employ, who's a good teacher, who's around for a long time, they're just going to go off and do it themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I think yeah. probably the big companies that do recruit and maintain, you know, a base of teachers, yeah. those teachers aren't necessarily going to be around for very long.
No, because I know this from personal experience. I remember back in 2005 when I saw how much Berlitz was charging per hour, because I used to pay that because I was learning Spanish, right? I was teaching English and learning. I was literally taking all my earnings because language learning was so expensive at the time. We didn't even have we didn't have apps. We didn't have Babel and all of the, you know, Duolingo. And back in the day when I saw how much the students were paying per hour and from that, how much was the teacher like me, the instructor getting? It was a tiny little fraction. Obviously, if you can undercut, you know, cut the middleman and do it yourself, that makes a lot of sense. But I'm so glad we're talking about this because this is one of the biggest obstacles that holds people back when they want to start their own thing. And that is the fear that it's already been done. Market is so crowded. There's so many players. And I know this, like I said, from personal experience when I was teaching English in South America and so many institutes and companies. But what makes you stand out? I feel like we're taking that full circle moment back with Rob's advice. Why us? Why now? And why not anyone else, right? What makes you do? When you can narrow that down, and you let your content speak for itself. it pays big dividends. So this is fantastic, Sam. We're coming to the part of this conversation where I want to get practical advice from you, because you are this superstar communication trainer, not just related to English language, but in general, because I'm sure you've seen the benefits of what you do, not only in advanced like English delivery, but also in terms of confidence when you speak. And you don't realize, did I say that in English or did I say that in Spanish? Did I say that in French? When you can't think about that, it's more about the delivery. Yeah. It's less about the tactics. But here, let us learn from you. We want to, you know, as what you can share with us in terms of strategies or tactics that can help to separate good communicators, you know, they're good enough, from great communicators. And especially when, you know, it may not be in their native language, or maybe it is in their native language, it doesn't matter. I'd love for you to share your favorite practical tips to help us to become more memorable communicators.
Okay, I think the fundamental thing to remember is that communication and public speaking is a skill. It's a skill. It's not a gift. It's not a talent. It's a skill. And as such, what you need to do is you need to learn techniques. And then once you've learned those techniques, you need to practice those techniques. And the more that you practice those techniques, the better you're going to get.
Yeah.
And so you have to start somewhere. And I think a lot of people have a barrier because it's taking that first step towards doing their first speech that is so intimidating for them. You know, that first step onto the stage, to feel the fear and do it anyway, as the expression goes.
Yeah.
That's the barrier to entry. And I think a practical tip is not to expect too much of yourself. Okay, dare to be mediocre. It's okay to be mediocre. It's okay not to be great the first time you get up and speak. It's okay to forget your lines. It's okay to speak too fast. It's okay to lose sleep over it. I mean, these things are absolutely natural and they're absolutely normal, particularly when you start, the first few times you do it. And don't be put off by that, because it's going to get easier. It's going to get better. You are going to develop your skills and you are going to be able to implement those skills. And as time passes and more you do it, they'll get to a point where you actually really start to enjoy it and realize what a privilege it is to get up and speak in front of a group of people and persuade them to do something that's going to make their lives better. So it is a journey and you need to take the first step, and the first step is the hardest step. And after that, the more you do it, the easier it gets.
Oh my gosh, that's so important. Take the pressure off. And we don't have to strive for greatness with our very first attempt, second attempt, or even fifth attempt. And I think what you said is very valuable. If you can hang on till it becomes enjoyable, because when you start enjoying yourself, you're already there. You've already won, you know, it doesn't matter how many claps, how many likes, how many showed up. It's less about that. It's more about, hey, that felt good. Like this was fun. Can we do this again?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, I do public speaking in Spanish and I'm starting, I've only done a few speeches in Spanish. And the first speech that I did, I spent 2 weeks regretting it, thinking, why did I do that? Because it was such a mediocre speech. And I could tell when I got off the stage that people were like, oh, thanks, that was great. That's what they were saying, but they weren't actually really meaning it. You know what I mean? And I was thinking, I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to get up and give a speech in Spanish because that's just not my thing. And then as time passes and you start to reflect and you start to become, you know, a little more philosophical about it, you say, well, actually, you know what? That was a learning experience. I've improved my Spanish through this process. I've kind of known things that do work and don't work. And if I do it again, I know it's going to be easier. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be easier. It's not necessarily going to be super successful, but it's going to be more successful. And so subsequently, I have done other public speaking events in Spanish, and I've been on radio shows in Spanish as well. And every time I say that's the same thing to myself, you know, don't expect this to be amazing. Don't expect this to really show your full talents, right? This is a journey that you're going through. This is a step in the journey, and you'll eventually get there. But you have to go through this in order to reach that point where you enjoy it and you feel like you're really delivering a great speech.
I'm so glad you shared that, because you have much more empathy than the average teacher or instructor for your students, because you're going through the same journey in another language. So what they're going through in English, right? It's not that you have sort of secondhand empathy. It's coming from directly from experience. And I think this is such great advice. I haven't shared this on LinkedIn because I'm very embarrassed. But I did an interview last year, a podcast interview I was invited to, and it was in French. And I was like, I keep saying we should face the fear and do it anyway. Maybe it's time to follow my own advice. So it was awful. I cringed so much when I went back and listened to it. I haven't shared it on LinkedIn because it was like, I used so many English fillers in there. They just came out. And you know, when you're like speaking the native language and suddenly you say English and you say English with your own accent, it's just so artificial. But the lesson learned was, maybe do something that scares you. Try. I think I decided to do it last year once per quarter. Do something that scares you, makes you come alive. It doesn't matter if you liked it or if it sounded awful. You did it, because there's so many people who will never do it because their ego will prevent them. And I don't care if I look like a fool to them. I didn't promote it, but it doesn't matter. And making that speech in Spanish, you've gone on to radio. You're speaking, and you've done videos on LinkedIn in Spanish with your beautiful Castellano, perfect, you know, accent that takes time. That takes time. You didn't just, you know, come out of your MBA speaking like that. So beautiful. Sam, I've loved this conversation so much. I know you said you have so many stories. If we could have our way, we would get so many more. But the last one I want to get out of is this particular question I ask every guest of mine. When you look back on your beautiful, illustrious career that you've had over all these decades, is there one standout, defining moment that supercharged your career and helped you to inch a little closer to your current success?
Yes, there is. There's a standout moment. And I kind of replay it in my mind like many, many times. It was when I was working as a summer intern at JP Morgan, and the market had already started to turn down. So other summer interns, as they were leaving, were not being offered full-time jobs. So I was on the equities trading floor thinking, what can I do in order to receive a full-time job at the end of this internship? And I booked a meeting with the head of equity sales, who's this like ex-military guy, quite scary. And I said to him, look, I love working here. I really want to have a full-time job at the end of this internship. What do I need to do? And he said, I'm going to give you two pieces of advice. Okay, you want to be in sales. So number one, you got to raise your profile. And number two, don't screw up. Right. So those were the two pieces of advice he gave me. As I walked out of the office onto the trading floor, I was thinking, okay, got to raise my profile, but I mustn't screw up at the same time. And I had like
about. What does that mean, though, Sam? Don't so raise your profile. What did he mean by that?
You have to be noticed. You have to have a reputation. You have to have credibility. When you're working, when you're working within a sales or marketing role, and it is to do with personal branding. Yeah. So I think profile, a modern term for that would be build your personal brand. Mm. So things weren't going particularly well. I don't think I had very much of a personal brand at that point, or very much of a profile. And then we were all invited to the JP Morgan summer barbecue held in Chelsea at this really lovely place. And I walked in to this garden center, and the whole of the trading floor was there. All the management were there. It was like a very buzzing atmosphere. People were enjoying themselves. And then in the corner, there was a grand piano with two speakers and a microphone.
Yeah.
And I asked one of my colleagues, what's the grand piano for? And they said, oh, that's for the head of sales. It's his thing, you know, his party piece. Like every time we organize something like this, he plays the piano and he sings a few songs. And I thought, okay, this is my moment, right? This is my moment. Raise my profile, but don't screw up, because I sing in a band and after a few drinks, I'm a karaoke king, right? I've not got the greatest voice, but after you've had a few drinks and I've had a few drinks, it sounds great. So that's what I did. I went to the bar, I had a few drinks, and then I went up to the head of sales and I said, I hear you play the piano. I want to sing with you. And he was like,
did you really have any fear when you said that, or you were too drunk to care?
I probably, after four or five bottles of beer, I think the fear had somewhat dissipated and the courage was there.
Yeah.
But yes, I did. But the thing was, I had nothing to lose at that point.
Yeah.
Because nobody was being offered jobs and I knew that I wasn't going to get offered a job. So I had to do something radical and this was it. So he kind of looked at me quizzically. He said, okay, right. I admire your courage. Come on then. What do you want to sing? And I said, just play a regular 12-bar blues and I'll improvise a few things. And that's what he did. He started playing an upbeat 12-bar blues on the piano. And then I just started singing one of the old 12-bar blues songs that I know. And like 400 people of the JP Morgan trading floor turned to look at us to see the head of sales on the piano with this like unknown summer intern singing a blues song to the whole crowd. And it was just one of those beautiful moments that worked.
Yeah.
And once he finished the song, he said to me, let's have another one. So he started playing another song. And for about 20 minutes, we played together. And at the end of those 20 minutes, there was a big round of applause. And the head of sales took the microphone from my hand and said, that is how you get a job as a summer intern. You are hired. And everybody in the crowd went crazy.
Oh, my God. So you were hired?
That's the moment I got hired, because he was the guy, he was the decision maker, and he was saying in front of everybody that I had the job. So it's like high fives, and suddenly I walked onto the trading floor the next day, and it's like people, you were the
they
guy
remember
that got
you. Oh my
I had God. Raised my profile. I had risked
you had raised your profile. You didn't screw it up, especially when everyone else has had a few drinks. That's even more helpful. But what courage, Sam, even if you had a few drinks, I still want to say that, you know, because you never know. Maybe he'd be like a classical guy. And what a risk, like the blues, and you just jammed. But I think that's the beauty of not caring, you know. You're like, what's the worst that'll happen? I'm anyway unemployed, right? Worst thing that'll happen is people remember me. Best thing that might happen is I might get an interview. You did better than that. You did one better. This is the most, probably one of the most unique answers I've heard to this question. And from then, it just, you know, a little bit of that, lose the inhibitions. What have I got to lose? And go for it. I see that in your LinkedIn videos every day. You're leaping into your swimming pool. I mean, you're having fun and, you know, your heart is in it. You're running a business. I'm so happy. I think LinkedIn is very lucky to have people like you, creators like you, but also this is supporting your family, right? This is not a hobby, expensive hobby anymore. This has helped you to maintain a good life with your kids, with your wife, and your wife is employed. I can see her marketing brains in action because I, you know, definitely see the whole sort of family in the mix. Fantastic. Sam, you're so fantastic. And you have written a book and you have a podcast with a very curious name, because this is all about the trials and adventures of this woman called Lola Badiola. And it's a top, top rated podcast. And it's also a book, and it's all about cybercrime, and highly recommend. I'm going to put all of these links in the notes of the episode. definitely want people to check that out. And what would, according to you, be the best way for people to learn more about you, Sat?
Well, it's, first of all, it's not just me. So it is me and my partner. She's also my wife, Marina Solana. So it's the two of us work together.
Partner, kind of business partner. I remember that video.
Partner, my business partner. She's both. Yeah. I am the face. I'm the front office, right? And everybody sees me. And I'm the guy that's built the personal brand. I mean, she is everything else. She's absolutely the foundation of the business. She's got strategic vision. She does the marketing. She does all the administration. So there's the two of us that work together. And so probably if you go onto our website, you'll see that we work together. Also, you'll see her in the videos from time to time as well. So it's a partnership between the two of us. And also we have written this book together. This is the book. There you go. That's our little plug for the book. That is The Adventures of Lola Badiola. It's also, as you say, a podcast that you can get on Spotify, and also it's on the LinkedIn Learning platform as well. So if you're a premium member of LinkedIn, you can access it with some extra materials there as well. So that's how you can access our free content. If you are interested in improving your business communication skills at a kind of high level, so you already have a super solid level of English, but you want a masterclass in all of the elements of business English that's going to make you a better persuader and a better leader, then we have a platform. It's called Club Grattan. That's
Club
the platform.
Grattan. Yes.
Yeah, you can join us on that. And we also offer workshops focused on public speaking, mainly aimed at non-native speakers.
Yes.
But it is in English, and native speakers are also welcome to join us for that as well. So, That's who we are.
I will definitely link that. I wish this platform existed when I was in South America. This is exactly what was. And I was like, you know, you're doing it out. So if you're listening and you're figuring things out on your own, particularly as a non-native English speaker, just sign up, because a lot of times companies pay for these sort of trainings as part of their training and development budget. I'm telling you from human resources, if you don't use that budget, you lose it. So I'm telling the listener, if you ask HR, there is a budget in place. Take advantage of Club Grattan. It sounds like Club Bed, but even better.
we went through so many different names. About a year, and then eventually we just came back to Club Grattan, you know, because it is a club.
You pay a subscription
fee. Yeah. We get to know you. You get to know us. You're with a group of other professional people just like you. And there's lots of like additional bonuses that you get, materials and access to materials that other people don't get. So it is a club.
Exactly. It is a club. And if you're lucky, you might even hear Sam, on his guitar, strumming out the blues, having a good old time with a bottle of beer.
The guitar is right here.
The guitar is right there.
The next time you invite me, I'm going to do a little bit of preparation. I'll play you a song.
Oh my gosh. This has been so much fun, Sam, to you and to Marina. And not to forget the kids, because this is a family, true family business. I wish you continued success with everything you do with Grattan Communications and beyond. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sonal. It's been a real pleasure chatting to you.
Hey there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to today's show. If you loved it, please do leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. I search high and low to bring you the very best guests, and I'm so proud to bring you their stories and game-changing career lessons. The best compliment that you could ever give me is taking a screenshot of today's episode and sharing it with your LinkedIn network and tagging me at Sonal Behal, SonalBahl. All right, I look forward to spending time together on the next episode of the How I Got Hired podcast. Take care of yourself, and bye for now.